Welcome back, everyone. I am Cass Piancy. I'm joined, as usual, by my partner in crime, Mr. Bennett Tomlin. How are you today?
Well, to be honest, it's 100 degrees here, and as someone who's 6'3" and 215 pounds, that's just not a very comfortable situation to be in. How are you doing, Cass?
Okay. I'm doing good. It's warm here, too. I just jumped out of the sauna, so I have different reasons for being sweaty and gross. I'm super excited to have someone on the show who's been covering Tether almost as long as we have in a really important and meaningful way. Zeke Fox, how are you today?
Great. Yeah, sitting pretty in like the air conditioning here in Brooklyn. And definitely you all have been covering Tether long before me. You'd already gone and returned from Hong Kong before I'd even started digging into it, right? I'm pretty sure.
Right. Yes. No, that's true. But yes, you've taken a lot of, you brought up my Hong Kong trip, but you took a lot of crazy trips. We're discussing your book, Number Go Up, which I highly recommend for anyone who's interested in cryptocurrencies, who's interested in fraud, who's interested in Tether, stable coins, cryptocurrency exchanges, whatever. You should get your hands on this book. It is the best book on cryptocurrencies I've read since at least Nathaniel Popper's Digital Gold. I think it's genuinely an important book for cryptocurrency advocates and critics alike. Everyone should get out there and check it out. But Zeke, like, why? Let's start. Why did you write this book?
Ever since I was like a teenager, I always loved reading these adventurous nonfiction books like John Krakauer's Into Thin Air, or more recently like David Grann and The Lost City of Z. And like, I've been an investigative reporter now for quite a while, but I never really found the right story. I never found a story that I thought could sustain a whole book, because like the last thing I wanted to do was write a boring book. And when I started looking into crypto, I got totally sucked in, and I was traveling around the world meeting like these overnight billionaires, these guys who seem totally like scammers, and I'm like, why are they hanging out with me? And I realized that, first of all, I was in the middle of the biggest financial mania that the world has ever seen. And second of all, like, this is the adventure story. This is the book I have to write. And I decided to do it and to do it as best I can, because I felt like, honestly, I was kind of surprised no one else was doing it. And I'm like, this is actually an important time in world history. Like, people are going insane. It's like, never before have been so many people been getting so rich off such like flimsy schemes. And I realized I was in a great place to chronicle it. And that's what I tried to do.
I was going to ask you, the first thing I've written down is, how does it feel knowing that by coming on this podcast, you'll never get another interview with Jan Ludovicus Vanderveld? But I guess considering Chalopin opened that interview by warning you he might kill you, perhaps that's not unwelcome. Do you have any thoughts on what it was like to kind of try and interview and meet some of these people during the process of going through this book?
So Jean Chalopin, the chairman of Deltek, I met a few years ago when I started looking into Tether. And if you're not like a super fan and aren't familiar, he literally created Inspector Gadget. Like, he had a really successful career in Hollywood. He got rich from that. He bought a castle somewhere in Europe. He bought this colonial mansion in the Bahamas that was the bad guy's house in the Bond movie Casino Royale. You might remember when Daniel Craig gets out of the water and like he's like with his glistening abs and there's like a girl riding on horseback?
Who could
forget? In the background, yeah. In the background, I think the bad guy's wife is like looking at him kind of like longingly. She's in Chalopin's house, or former house. So I emailed him at the time. He eventually invested in this bank in the Bahamas called Deltek. And Deltek became a key banker for Tether. Because Tether, like the central mystery of Tether, right, is like they say it's backed by dollars. Supposedly they have tens of billions of dollars in the bank, but they've never quite provided satisfactory accounting for that money. So at the time, Chalopin was one of the only, or the only banker who would say, like, I'm holding some money for Tether. And he was totally cool. He invited me to his office. We had a long talk.
Actually, can I pause you right there? Because you, in your book, bring up that when you enter his office, he pulls down a book about, like, criminal fraud, or, like, I forget the exact, like, what exactly it was about, but just, it's just stunning to me that, like, you walk into his office and he already is like, ah, money is this very funny criminal thing, isn't it? And it's just like, what is happening right now? What is this,
yes.
You know?
I mean, it was totally wild. And, but, so I have to say, like, with your original question, he's been nothing but honorable with me. We've become pretty friendly. And, like, when he comes to New York, we'll sometimes meet up. And I hope that he feels like this book is a fair portrayal of everything that happened. It's easy to jump to conclusions, like in crypto world. And I haven't seen any proof that, other than serving as Tether's banker, that, well, that's a long question. But he's been totally cool with me, and I hope that this, he feels like the book is fair.
Yeah, on that point, there was a couple interesting details about him that were kind of new to me, or framed in a new light, which helped me understand some things. Like that when Tether started banking at Deltek Bank and Trust, Juan Carlo Davicini purchased the piece of property right next to Chalapin down on the beach, so they could be neighbors. Or what was really interesting to me was, in one of your conversations with him, he was talking about how when Tether first started banking there, and they issued that November 2018 letter from him that said Tether had all the assets they were supposed to have, which was a thing he referred back to in his interview with you, was at that period, Tether didn't have all the assets they said they had, because their public representations as of November 2018, when that letter came out, was that Tether was holding all cash. And the CFTC and New York AG case revealed at November 2018, when this was occurring, part of it was not in cash. It was in bonds and other securities. So even when Chalapin was making these representations and saying, like, everyone was worried Tether didn't have what they said they had, he was aware Tether didn't have what they said they had, or should have been aware.
Okay, so that detail is not one that I have fresh in my head, mm-hmm. in terms of what they had said exactly about the composition at that time. But, and I don't want to be like the Tether's PR person here, but what I would say that is, at that time, the question was more like, is this all made up? And they had some money, they had it, or maybe it was invested in some stuff, they had it in his bank. And he was quite honest with me when he said that, you know, at that time, he knew about all the money. Now they had other bankers, and he wasn't going to say for sure that he knew what was going on with their whole banking situation. And over time, I think Deltek has become like a less important part of Tether's banking relationships.
Yes, I think Capital Union Bank has now kind of taken on that role, at least from what we know. But I do want to push back as a skeptic on the statements there, because I do think that you might be right that some people have always stated, like, oh, there's no money in Tether. Sure. Okay. But, like, I think what has largely been the skeptic or critical component of what people are talking about Tether isn't that there's no money there. It's, how did the money get there? Where is this money from? And what are they doing with the money? Is it legal, right? I think that is more along the lines of what criticisms and skepticisms about Tether have been for a few years now, as opposed to, like, they never had any money to begin with. And I wonder how you feel about that question, as opposed to, oh, they don't have any money at all.
Yeah, I mean, I keep going back and forth on Tether and say, you think, like, hey, if they really are telling the truth all the time now, why can't they prove it better? And, like, they have this whole history of misleading statements. They've been sued for lying by the New York Attorney General. And yes, I definitely thought it was more interesting as I went on to explore this question of, like, who's using Tether? And Tether, I went all the way to Cambodia to check this out. It's kind of a crazy story. As it started with a spam text message, like one of those spam texts that we all get, said, like, hey, David, it's Vicky Ho. Like, what's going on? I looked into these spam text messages. I'm sure you're familiar. It's like this scam called pig butchering. And this Vicky Ho, who I was talking to, she tried to make friends with me. she eventually started dropping hints that she was great at crypto trading and I might want to trade with her. Then she had me download like this crypto trading app. And when it came time for her to get my money, she was like, hey, I've got a really safe way for you to transfer money to me. Get like a regular crypto app like Coinbase or crypto.com or something. Buy some of this coin called Tether. It's backed by dollars. It's stable. And then send the Tether to my trading app and we'll make like a lot of money together. And what I started talking to more experts on pig butchering, and I found that Tether, for whatever reason, is the favorite currency of these crypto scammers, and that people are sending like huge amounts of Tether to scammers. Like people will send over their like whole life savings. It's really wild.
You just said something interesting to me, because you explained the scam, but you said for some reason they are choosing Tether. Do you have any insight into why they would be choosing Tether?
One thing that makes Tether appealing is that, although this could be true of a lot of cryptocurrencies, like when I send it over, it's irrevocable. It's not like there's no one, there's no chargebacks like on a Visa card. Like it would set up all sorts of red flags at my bank if I tried to send money to like some random company in Cambodia. But with Tether, I can just zap it over to Vicky Ho. Even people were sending over, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it's instant or relatively instant, and you can never get it back. But I think, like, honestly, a lot of the appeal is that it's a stable coin. Like, even the criminals don't want to deal with value fluctuations by, like, accepting Ethereum or something like that. And it's part of their pitch, too. Some of them will do, they'll say, like, that they're never, that you're just going to deposit the Tether in the smart contract and you'll earn interest. So it's part of the appeal is that it is dollar backed and that it's supposed to have a stable value at one, and that, yeah, they take advantage of that for their pitch. And some people I talked to said that this accounts for like billions of dollars, like a crazy amount of money is lost to these scams.
Well, and one thing you mentioned there is that Tether is irrevocable, which isn't actually true. And it's something you've talked about in the book and something we talk about on here before, which is that Tether has the ability and offers a service where they will freeze tethers that are associated with certain types of scams or certain sizes of scams. But during your course of reporting for this book, they informed you that they are not willing to do that if the scam falls below their line. Did that surprise you to find out?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of a weird stance they have where they will freeze assets sometimes. Like, they will comply with law enforcement requests. Like, I could imagine a crypto company saying, hey, it's on the blockchain, we don't control it. They're showing that they do have the power. And just jumping ahead a little bit here, like, the crazy part of this pig butchering story is that the scammers are themselves victims of human trafficking. So, like, there are these office buildings in Cambodia that are just full of, like, floor after floor of people who've been tricked. They've been offered like good jobs. They travel from other countries. And then when they show up, they're forced to send these spam messages and scam people. And the companies
like
that are doing
Andrew
this.
Andrew Tate level kind of scam, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're beaten. They're shocked with these like taser sticks. It's people are killed. It's truly horrible. It's like an international human rights issue. Thousands of people have been tricked like this. And the bad guys are often Chinese gangsters. So this is like a really, really bad crime, right? And I spoke to, there's this kind of amateur organization that's trying to, of people who've been victimized financially by pig butchering, but then decided that they wanted to help the human trafficking victims. And it's called the Global Anti-Scam Organization, or GASO. And so these people shared some communications that victims had had with Tether, where the victims are saying, hey, I've been scammed. Can you freeze these tethers and get them back to me? And Tether, as you pointed out, in some cases they will freeze accounts, but here they made all sorts of excuses, like it sounds like it's just a dispute between two people. We don't want to get involved. It's not very much money. And in one they said, we would only intervene if there was violence involved, which I thought was just like a bizarre statement. And here, clearly, there is violence involved. So, look, if Tether was a bank, their position would be totally untenable because their position is sort of like, hey, we only deal with wholesalers. Well, I'm going to back up a little bit for if you're not like an expert on this. Tether coins are sold in big chunks to like crypto exchanges or big traders. So if you're like a major crypto whale, you can buy, you can send cash to Tether's bank and receive Tether tokens or the other way around. But if you're like a regular person or a Chinese gangster, you get the Tether tokens some other way. You buy them on a crypto exchange. You pay cash for them from if someone sends them on their phone. And so Tether doesn't know who you are. And Tether says they don't need to. Their responsibility is only to the people that they interact with directly. And once the tokens are out in the world, that's just sort of like crypto land, not really their problem in general.
I would suggest like the comparison here would be something along the lines of like, if I go and get $1,000 from my bank and then I start spending that money in the physical world, they can't control what I'm spending that money on anymore. If I'm buying drugs with it, if I'm buying sex with it, if I'm buying whatever, like they can't control what I'm spending the physical cash on. Like after I've already gotten the cash from the bank, right?
That's cash. Now, in this case, like let's say I have Tether on my phone, right? In some sort of wallet. Like I have a blockchain address, which is just like a string of numbers and letters. And that address is associated with a certain amount of real money that Tether's holding on my behalf. I would compare it to like a Swiss bank with a numbered account back in the day. Just because it's crypto doesn't mean that it's somehow something different. Like these guys are holding money on behalf of their customers, even though they claim that these guys are not their customers.
I think this is the same kind of story that Bennett and I had with Tether, which is that you start getting into all of these, what other word are we going to use? Scams, right? There's all these Ponzi's and scams and frauds that are operating in the cryptocurrency industry in general, whether it's like totally fake ones like OneCoin where they don't even have a blockchain, or something like Stepin where they say it's Ponzinomics, it's not a Ponzi, whatever, right? Like there's these different categories of it. But what you ended up focusing on, and this happened to Bennett and I as well, was that it was like, if Tether went away, all of these are going to go, like they cannot survive without Tether. How did you come to that conclusion?
In the early days of crypto, I realized that so many of these companies, crypto companies, had a problem, which was that banks didn't really want to deal with them. And like, to me, one of the key parts of starting a crypto company is that other people send me real money and then I give them crypto tokens. So like, step one is very key to me. I need some bank to be able to accept the real money from other people. And banks were flagging any crypto stuff as suspicious activity. This even as late as like 2018, Sam Bankman-Fried was having trouble with this when he was starting his crypto trading company, Alameda. And Tether was like, the people who came up with Tether had an idea. Tether's owners also run a crypto exchange, Bitfinex. And Bitfinex had issues with banks, and they thought, we could solve this by separating the crypto exchange part from the accepting real money part. So the idea, which wasn't really pursued, but was that original idea was that Bitfinex could be a crypto-only exchange and Tether could be the ones that accepted real money. So essentially, like if you wanted to go to the crypto casino, first you would go to the cashier, which was Tether. You would trade your real money for Tether tokens, and then you'd take those tokens to the casino. And like Tether played that role for a lot of people in crypto, where it was the way that real money was getting into this whole crypto ecosystem.
It was one of the only ways outside of like an on-ramp, off-ramp of an exchange, right? Back in the day.
Definitely. And I think it's become like there's more and more on and off-ramps, or it got to be like less crucial, but still was a way that everyone was moving around. If they had to move around big sums of money, Tether was the way they did it. And it tied together like so many people in the crypto world. So like, as I write in the book, looking into Tether pretty early on brought me to FTX and had brought me to meet Sam Bankman-Fried, who is like the boy genius of crypto with this exchange worth like $20 billion, a star in Washington and Silicon Valley, and yet like a huge user of this coin that, as I write in the book, seemed to be quilted out of red flags. So it's just like a really weird situation to me. And I felt like Tether was tied so many of these people together. And it made like a really interesting, looking into Tether brought me into like all the weirdest places in the crypto world. It was a lot of fun.
And what was kind of interesting to me in reading this is how so much of Tether's history and function is still kind of shrouded, and it's kind of unclear what happened. Like even the founding itself, there's a divergence in narratives among some of the founders and early executives. Like if you listen to Brock Pierce, he was the doula for creation, as he said to you, and brought together William Quigley, Jonathan Yantis, Craig Sellers, Reeves, and started this stablecoin, originally Realcoin, and then partnered with Bitfinex. It became Tether. They gave it away and whatever.
But Bennett, slow down. Hold on. You're running through this like everyone totally knows what's going on here.
Yeah, let me talk about Brock for a minute, because he's like one of the greatest characters in crypto world.
Great being a euphemism.
Well, he was a child actor. If you watch The Mighty Ducks in the classic Disney, you know, kids hockey movie, in the beginning, he plays the coach in a flashback where he misses a crucial penalty shot. And he was like a pretty successful child actor. I mean, you could talk about his career for quite a while. Brock has his child acting career. As a teenager, he gets a job at this dot-com startup run by this guy named Mark Collins Rector. They claim that they're inventing like the future of video by making these like short web series, but like the technology is not there yet. And like the web series are truly bizarre. And this guy, Mark Collins Rector, yes, Den, Digital Entertainment Network. Very dark story. You could read about it in the book, but he ends up fleeing to Spain and getting charged with sexual offenses. Pierce is not charged, and Pierce goes on to start a virtual item trading company. Like, he starts this World of Warcraft gray market company where, like, basically, there was a lot of people playing these massively multiplayer online games.
EverQuest.
And collecting, like, EverQuest, yeah. And, like, let's say you didn't want to spend, like, 93 hours, like, kicking pigs, but you wanted to get the, like, rare Sword of Waldorf. So people were, like, going on eBay and buying these items and having them delivered within the game. And the game companies didn't like this because it encouraged there to be like bots. And actually, kind of in like a weird version of the crypto scamming that I wrote about later, there were gold farmers in China who would have to like sit around all day long playing World of Warcraft repetitively to earn coins that they could then sell to like rich players in Western countries. And so Brock Pierce had a company that was like a middleman that was buying the gold from the gold farmers and selling it to players with cash who didn't want to kick pigs.
And this is IGE, right? Mm-hmm.
IGE, yeah. He ends up working with Steve Bannon there, which is kind of nuts. Bannon comes in as like chairman or CEO, brokers a big sale of the company or an investment, and Pierce walks away with like, I think, $20 million, I think from his virtual item trading background is like sees the potential in cryptocurrencies and some of the appeal of them and starts like a cryptocurrency investment fund. And then this is where, as you were saying, the history of Tether gets kind of disputed. He gets involved with Tether. He's definitely like a co-founder, but it's like there's like six people who all say that they are the ones who came up with the idea for Tether. And I did my best to try to look into like who deserves the most credit. But it's like a very it's difficult to figure out.
It's fascinating because that part of the story I had never heard, and from what I had heard, like if we go back years and years and years, the story told to everyone was one. First of all, they tried to hide the fact that Tether had been purchased by Bitfinex. So this idea that there was as far as I know, it first was exposed when the Panama Papers came out. Isn't that right, Bennett? What's wrong with that?
There's again conflicting history here, because the earliest versions of Tether's website that you can find right before they made the initial announcement on Bitcoin Talk brag about having the same executive team as Bitfinex.
Oh.
Shortly, around the time they announce it, that goes off Tether's website. And Juan Carlo on Bitcoin Talk is talking about how he hopes he gets an invite to this new Tether service soon because he's excited to try it out, right? So this is when they start denying it's together again. At a certain point here, one of the executives acknowledges they work together really closely. Then they go back to denying it until we get to the Wells Fargo lawsuit when they get debanked in Taiwan. Then they file the lawsuit together against Wells Fargo. Phil Potter goes into the Whale Pool team speak and tries to make the claim, no, we're not the same company. We just happened to bank at the same places. We got debanked at the same time. And so we came together for this lawsuit that's important for all of the cryptocurrency ecosystem. Then the Paradise Papers come out. And then it's really definitive. They can't really get around it. But they had at times before that demonstrated and then went back on whether or not they were interrelated.
That's a very interesting question. Definitely, you're more in the weeds on their representations back then than I am. But, you know, I realize we've brought up a few times Giancarlo DiVicini, who has got to be like one of the best characters that I came across in crypto world. So he was not one of the original founders of Tether. He's a Italian. He was trained as a plastic surgeon. He's from Milan. And he walked away from his career in plastic surgery when he was maybe 25. He had kind of a quarter-life crisis. And he wrote at the time that like his whole career seemed like a lie and that he couldn't do it anymore. He got into like the import-export business and was bringing in RAM, laptop parts, assembling laptops. He was charged with counterfeiting by Italian authorities, settled the case, and long story short, he ended up just learning about Bitcoin early on, making a big investment in it, I'm told, and then investing in Bitfinex, the crypto exchange, which was fairly successful early on. So after Tether got started, Bitfinex took it over, and although he's on paper the CFO, everyone tells me he's the boss, he's the guy that runs Bitfinex and Tether. And so a lot of the book I spend trying to figure out his mysterious past and trying to talk with him about Tether, answer some of these questions I have, and find out what he thinks about how this stablecoin that allows people to instantly move dollars around the world, clearly having all sorts of interesting effects, to find out how he feels about all that. He is not the founder, but maybe deserves a lot of the credit for or blame for how big and successful Tether has been.
The story of him leaving the surgery job is just endlessly fascinating to me. This is a guy who trained for years to become a plastic surgeon, does it for 1 week and then, or a few days, a couple weeks, whatever, gets asked to do a breast reduction and then just ghosts the clinic, apparently, to move to China, is his version of the story that you tell in the book, is he moves over there and then starts this import-export business. And sometime after this is when we know he starts kind of running, eventually, this import-export business is when he starts collaborating with Jan Ludovicus Vandervelde, with him running Perpetual Action Group Monaco and Jan Ludovicus running Perpetual Action Group Asia, and then collaborating together as part of this kind of import-export scheme. And so I just think that's, it's such a strange career path for him to go from training for years to being, to be a surgeon, doing it so briefly before immediately entering this like electronics import-export business, and then eventually ending up in crypto after a couple years after some mysterious fires when his generators go up at his production facility. It's fantastical. You can't make up Juan Carlo De Vicini.
And I'm actually not sure how long he was a plastic surgeon for, if it was actually, I'm not sure it was that short, but it was definitely not long for someone who'd spent all this time training. And one part of the book that I had a lot of, that was fascinating for me is, I mean, I went to Milan, I visited this clinic where he'd worked. I felt like I was hitting a dead end. And then on Google, in the comment section of an old Italian political blog, I found that he was posting, and that he posted a link to a website that's almost like a online diary. And so we should say, like, Giancarlo, kind of a mysterious figure. He never gives interviews.
Just for what it's worth, he used to be present pretty regularly in forums and
Bitcoin Talk. He was super
Bitcoin
active
Talk.
On,
he would post on Bitcoin.
No, not
Talk.
Bitcoin. No, but Whale.
Whale
what's
pool.
The fucking
he
Whale Pool?
A
thank
ton
you,
of
Jesus
time
Christ.
In Whale Pool. He went in there like once or twice. Mostly that was like Phil and Zane doing that.
Yeah, Phil usually, but Giancarlo also would occasionally drop in there and talk to these people. And as you know, Zeke, because he commented about your article, he did briefly appear on Twitter to comment and get mad about what you were saying. To both of your points here, I think what's really crazy about all of this, right? So we have Brock Pierce, child actor. We have Giancarlo, who is a plastic surgeon turned import exporter. We have VDV, Ludovicus Vanderveld, who is an import exporter. The only one with real financial background is Phil Potter, which is why when he tries to take credit for basically creating Tether, I actually believe him more than I believe the rest of these schmucks.
Yeah, I think Phil definitely was very important. He was the like operationally making this happen. And where it was hard to figure out, the harder part to figure out was like who had the idea for a dollar-backed stablecoin.
Sure.
Liberty
but
Reserve.
I think that idea was kind of floating around. That's the conclusion I come to, is that a lot of people were kind of talking about, wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah, and Liberty Reserve had happened in the like 6 or so years
exactly.
Right before Tether was founded. They got indicted, arrested in 2013. Tether was founded in 2014, if I remember right. So like in that lead up, there were people doing not blockchain-based,
similar,
but other kind of tokenized representations of dollars like that.
So I do want to bring up, so you got to meet Vanderveld, which is like no one else that I know has had this opportunity. And I think it was just such a confusing interview that I like when you're talking to him, the things he's saying don't mesh with reality for me. And I just want to know what your perception was upon discussing Tether with him and stuff, because one of the statements he made, and maybe I'm misquoting here, but something along the lines of like, I don't like money. I don't care about money. You're running an $80 billion stablecoin. How can you possibly say that out loud? Like, what are you talking about? Anyway, yeah, please. I'd just love to hear your experience with VDV.
Yeah, I mean, it was really exciting. JL Vanderveld, he's the CEO of Tether on paper, though we're all told he's sort of a number two to Giancarlo. He's so under the radar that some people speculated that he didn't really exist. but, like, when I set out on this mission to get to the bottom of this stuff, I was like, you have to see this all the way. So I was really determined to find these guys and interview them. And I went to Sam Bankman-Fried's Crypto 2022 conference in the Bahamas. It's April 2022. One of the reasons I went was I was thinking the Tether guys might come. I mean, Bankman-Fried is by some measures, their biggest customer. Giancarlo has a house in the Bahamas. All the big crypto traders were going to be there. I figured maybe it was worth a shot. Maybe he'd come. And as I describe in the book, at first I was a bit disappointed. I didn't see any Tether representatives anywhere. But then I got a message from Jean Chalopin, who very nicely was like, hey, actually, JL Vanderveld is at the conference. Do you want to meet the CEO of Tether? And he gave me a little, by this point we were friendly, and he gave me like a friendly, some friendly advice, which was like, they feel very attacked by the press. Be careful how you approach them. And then he's like, come over right now. And I go into the, I run down the hallway, and he's standing next to this tall, handsome man with silver hair, who, and he, I walk up to them, Jean introduces me, and he says, totally joking, but he says, like, don't screw this up or I'll kill you. At the moment, I didn't laugh, but, like, I, it was a good line. Extend my hand to Vanderveld, and I'm like, nice to meet you, meet, and he says, the man who didn't, who doesn't exist. Like, he knows about the rumors, and, like, he enjoys them. So we ended up sitting down, just me and Jean Vanderveld for, I'm going to say, like, 3 hours in, like, a little bar in the within this casino where the conference was. And it was, like, a really intense conversation, but I felt like it was just going in circles. And at this point, this is kind of funny in hindsight. I had recently been to Sam Bankman-Fried's offices in the Bahamas. I'd spent like a couple days there, and Bankman-Fried let me just sit next to him, and I just would like chat with him while he's doing business. Like, I'm reading his emails over his shoulder. I'm reading his Slack messages. Like, he really put on this show that he had nothing to hide. So I told Vanderveld about this, and I'm like, why don't you, if everyone's making up all these lies about you, why not just like come clean, show people what the truth is, give an interview, like show people how your company is really run. And he said, well, that's, you know, that's so easy for Sam to do. You know, we've been here since the start. Like, we've had to take our lumps. You know, you don't know what we've been through. He just came in. He's like standing on our shoulders. And now, it's easy for him to have a reporter over. Meanwhile, he actually had a reporter over while he was running what seems to be like one of the biggest frauds since Bernie Madoff. Yeah, Vanderveld, he really wanted to talk a lot about just like how he had been mistreated by the press, incorrect stories about him, people's, why didn't, sort of like the world these days, why don't we trust each other? it was really like a strange conversation. And kind of like light on substance. And as you said, like, he tried to say,
isn't that a weird thing for somebody involved in blockchain in general to be saying, right? Like, the whole concept of Bitcoin is like about trustlessness, is about like not trusting other people with money and finance. Like, and then he's like, why don't we trust people? Like, I'm running this massive $80 billion stablecoin. Why doesn't everybody just trust me? Why do you think they don't? I don't know.
Right. Well, and the reason is like you've made misrepresentations. Tether has made misrepresentations in the past about its backing. They haven't given us like reason to trust them. So they've kind of invited this scrutiny, and it was really bizarre. I was thrilled to meet him, but I felt like I'd gotten no closer to figuring out the truth about him or about his company.
It's so, and everything you were mentioning that he was saying is just so hypocritical to the way that he actually lives his life as well. Like, this dude has property in Hong Kong, in like one of the most expensive parts of Hong Kong that there is. Like, his family gets to travel the world, all expenses paid. Like, it's just wild to me that this guy is saying, like, I don't care about money. People should trust us. Like, what's the big deal? And it's like, do you see the life that you're leading and how the whole thing is wild to me. Again, like I just think everyone needs to read your book because these things are crazy.
I mean, that's like the crypto world. Like in no other industry would these people rise to the top, where you'd have like Brock Pierce, like the child actor, becoming like a crypto prophet, traveling the world, like one of the most prominent spokespeople for crypto. Like if you go back and look at all the people, my first crypto conference was Bitcoin 2021 in Miami. And one of the first people I met there was Alex Mashinsky, who was running Celsius. And we sat down for an interview. I hadn't really done much prep work. And all I knew was that he ran a crypto company and there were some ties to Tether, so he could maybe help me out with some info on Tether.
An investment by Tether.
Yes. I knew that Tether had invested in Celsius, so I figured he at least knew the Tether people. And I promise this is going to relate to what I was talking about, but I'm like a polite guy. So before I get into like my questions, I'm like, hey, Alex, can you tell me a little bit about your crypto company, Celsius? And he's like, well, if you give us your crypto, we'll pay you really high yields, like 10 or 20%. But if you want a loan, we lend to you at like 0%. So like that's the opposite of banking. That's how a way to lose money. Like you pay people tons of money, but you don't earn any money. And yeah. Like he had a lot of, so I'm just sitting here. I'm like, all right, the conference was full of dumb ideas. So I'm like, all right, here's another one. I'm like, well, so how much do you manage, thinking it's not going to be like, it's going to be pretty low. And he's like, oh, like $20 billion. And I'm like, oh my God. And the guy's on paper, he was a billionaire. And he's sitting there with this like sales pitch that like, to me, you know, I wouldn't buy like a new mop from him on Home Shopping Network or whatever. In crypto, there were these people with these crazy backstories, with these crazy personas who rose to the top. And for like, I feel like people have sort of forgotten, but for like a couple of years, these people were treated not on Crypto Critics Corner, but in like a lot of the media and in Washington and with venture capitalists. These people were treated like this was maybe the future of finance and that these were like really legit, respectable companies. And like time and again, when I would look behind the curtain, investigate the companies a little bit, I would just find that like there wasn't anything there. Like it was not the great innovation that they were claiming was not there.
What was interesting to me is that through a lot of your book, lying is kind of a theme. The very first beginning of the prologue opens with Sam Bankman-Fried saying, "I'm not going to lie," when he's talking to you before immediately launching into a series of lies. You talk about how Alex Mashinsky once said, somebody is lying, either the bank is lying or Celsius is lying. And even Vanderveld, despite not being willing to tell you whatever was the big secret in the past, said, once you start a lie, sooner or later it will come back to bite you. What were some of the challenges and experience you had covering this story, this industry, where so many participants were willing and ready to lie about everything straight to your face?
You know what? As a writer, what I love is when people will talk to me. You can say what you want. I just want to hang out and see how you're, observe you at work, see what your life is like, and so that I can tell the story of like what I saw as a really exciting time in history. This brings up a maxim that I heard called the bullshit asymmetry principle. It was created by like this Italian programmer. This was kind of the challenge. And what he says is that it's much easier. The amount of energy needed to create bullshit is orders of magnitude lower than the amount of energy needed to correct the bullshit. So what that means is that like I could go to this crypto conference, they just bring in people, I'd meet them. Each one of them tells me this like crazy story about their coin and how great it is. Like there's not enough time in my life to investigate all of these coins. And when so many of the ideas are so flimsy, it's very hard to, you can't investigate them the way you would investigate like a crooked lending company, which is something that I would do in the past. Like, how do you investigate Stepin, which is like, you buy these digital shoes and we pay you green Satoshi tokens if you walk around wearing your digital shoes. Like, there's almost like nothing to investigate there. And yet, people are making like tons of money on these schemes. And in fact, people were getting like sucked into it and losing lots. You know, regular people were.
And what you're talking about there, I remember Cass and I finally did our episode on Terra like 3 weeks before it collapsed. But for like 3.5 months before that, since I had published my big research report on it, I'd been like, this thing's really big and we should talk about it. And Cass kept going, this is too stupid to talk about. There's nothing and, there. The entire thing is like pointless and obviously flawed. What are we going to talk about? And then it
and
ended
that's
up-
not even that's not even like we had been told about Luna and Terra years before it became a large gigantic thing. An auditor friend of us of ours like specifically had come to us and been like, look at this crazy idea for a stablecoin. Don't you guys think this is crazy? And we both were like, yeah, sounds totally insane, like everything else in the cryptocurrency industry, like whatever. But yeah. I think what I briefly just want to mention here is that you bring up this idea that like the internet has or like new forms of communication and stuff and all of this have like created this atmosphere of like lying being like you can't match the bullshit. But I don't even know if that's true, because I think this is like, this is such an old issue. This is something from like the 1800s, 1700s, where you go back and you find these quotes like falsehood flies and truth comes limping after it, right? Like this is known stuff where people are like, people will just bullshit you until they are forced to tell you the truth. As Bennett was saying, how did you cut through the bullshit? I want to know how. I want to know how you were able to. Were you able to? Sometimes were you just like, I guess I just have to believe the lies for now.
I can't say that I was always able to. And like Terra Luna is a good example. Like you, I had heard like, oh, this one is like a fishy one. You might want to look into it. Mm. But it was like so fishy on its face, it was kind of hard to figure out. Like, as a reporter, if you're writing an expose, you want to bring forward, like, new facts that are going to change people's minds. And in, like, the crypto world, people are already so ready to believe, and they're so bought in, that, like, what is it that's going to change? What is this new information that you have that they really want to hear? Like, I wrote a story that was before, maybe, like, 6 months before Celsius failed, that it wasn't, like, the toughest story, but it said, like, hey, there's a lot of red flags. There's questions about how they make their money. This guy has a sketchy past. And it was totally ignored. Like, nobody cared. And that's because, like, the people that invested in Celsius were real believers. They didn't care. And the people who didn't invest in Celsius kind of, like, had already dismissed it as something they don't care about. I would say one thing that was effective talking with crypto guys is I would often ask, like, hey, where are people using this in the real world? Like, how can I try this out? Let me try your product. Let me meet, can I interview people who use your product? And like, I think that cut through a lot of it. Crypto guys love to talk about like Bitcoin in El Salvador. And like, you go there, you talk to Salvadoran people and they're like, what? Like, no, we don't use Bitcoin. Why would we do that? What are you even talking about? Like, Axie Infinity was this crypto game that everyone was talking about as, like, the future, the best example of Web3. And then you actually go to the real world. I went to the Philippines. I talked with people who had invested, like, their savings, like, real amounts of their savings into this crypto game, like taxi drivers, social workers, regular people, and lost it, you know? So I think, like, because it's easy to make these crypto startups like sound cool. A lot of the ideas sound great on paper, but I'm like, let's judge by the results. Like, what are you doing? What are you doing right now? How can I see this in use?
I think you really kind of nailed this sentiment in the book when you had the line, a journalist composing a painstaking expose of a crypto scam seemed like a restaurant critic writing a takedown of Taco Bell, which is a feeling I've had at times when I'm like, digging into whatever the dumbest new coin is, and I'm like, well, this is really dumb for all these reasons, but everyone involved seems to believe it's dumb. They're all bragging about how dumb it is on Twitter, so what am I even saying? And, like, I think this was even compounded for me in some of the, like, crypto events you went to. You talked about going to, I think it was a Brock Pierce party in Puerto Rico, where James Katopoulos of Typhon Capital Management was discussing Donald Trump Jr.'s promotion of Let's Go Brandon Coin. And when you ask, like, is that allowed? Is that a thing they should or can be doing? And his response was just, they're allowed to make money. Fuck the SEC. And it just kind of seemed like throughout many of these events, there was kind of the, or at another one, or at, on the yacht, there was one of the attendees who was joking about joking with another attendee about a scam they specifically were running. Like, in the social circles of crypto that you were kind of moving through to write this book, there seemed to be almost a tacit acceptance that their colleagues and friends were running scams. How did that kind of affect the story going through this?
I should say the comments by James, I just overheard those. I had not asked him any questions. You know, I would say that the most common sentiment when people were talking to me was they would be like, yes, like 90% of crypto is a scam, but mine is good. Now I'm looking back on it. I'm like, the people who told me that are in jail. I just feel like the hunt for this like great crypto coin is not worth it. Like, the track record is that so many of them have turned out badly and have made lots of money for insiders, but none for the people who, come in late.
Well, I think that was actually one of the more powerful pieces of framing in the book, is you start with this story of one of your friends who calls you to tell you they invested, I'm assuming, a disposable portion of their wealth into Dogecoin and were playing around with that. And then that was kind of part of your impetus to look into some of this and to understand this industry. But as you go throughout, you move from kind of that first world type of gambling into human trafficking, effectively slavery, these communities in the Philippines that were effectively gutted by believing in these play-to-earn promises and these things like that. People in El Salvador who were sold a false promise of the ability of Bitcoin to save their country's finances. How did kind of that part of the story, starting at kind of like what I think of as this more milquetoast, mundane, first world kind of gambling type, into more of these like gross human rights abuses, affect your view of crypto as you wrote this story?
I mean, it was really surprising for me. Like, I thought of it, like you said, it seemed like kind of this weird offshore casino. But as I got deeper into it, I saw that it was having these effects in the real world. What really struck me was that the people who were talking about it, who were promoting it so confidently, it seemed like they really had no idea what was going on in these other countries. You remember, like, Axie Infinity, people talked this up like it was great. And then once it failed, you just didn't hear about it anymore. It was like totally memory hold. Or somehow they still maintain that like people in El Salvador love Bitcoin. And like anybody who went there would see that nobody's using it. It's not a thing. I mean, the Cambodia part was really upsetting. And I spoke to a police officer from Taiwan who'd spent his career working on like human trafficking type cases. And he said that some of these human trafficking scammers now were using Tether to buy and sell their victims. Like, these workers are sold to other compounds. And he was like, yeah, it makes it like a lot harder for me to track. With like a bank, you would have some leads. These cryptocurrencies, like, I don't know how to investigate it. So I felt like if you are creating these like companies that are having such a big impact around the world, it's your responsibility to learn about what's really going on and how it's being used.
What are your expectations now? Bennett and I, we've had some discussions lately about the future of cryptocurrency and our place in it. And we both settled on it will exist indefinitely, as far as we can both tell, at least in some niche form, regardless. But I'm curious what your thoughts are. Like, what do you think is next?
I don't think we'll ever see a bubble like the one that we just saw. It depends on new people coming in and putting in their real money. Like, that's what's turning these like Brock Pierce, if he's a billionaire, or like Sam Bankman-Fried into billionaires. And like, who is going to, and the appeal of crypto, despite what a lot of people say, I think for most people, the appeal is like, I'm going to buy some coin and then it'll double and I'll make a lot of money. And like, I think it's lost that appeal now that nearly like every coin has crashed and a lot of the biggest companies have been revealed to be frauds. So it's hard for me to imagine it just coming back the way that I think a lot of crypto promoters hope that it will. Like, I still follow all these guys on Twitter, and like, people are trying to make, what's it called? Like Harry Potter, Shiba Inu, Sonic Obama 10 coin happen. You seen this one?
Yeah.
I try to stay disconnected like, from that type of thing for my own health and safety.
Like, their efforts are so weak now. I just can't see this ever being replicated. I feel like you'd need a new story to tell people that would draw people in, instead of just being like, oh, this time crypto is going to work out great for you. Time to invest.
I don't know if you know Liz Lopato. She's a friend of the show. She's over at The Verge. She's fantastic, wonderful journalist. But she had a similar take as you, where she just said, so many people got burned this last time and have come away with the mindset of, oh, it's all a scam. Regardless of whether it is or not, like, that has been the takeaway for a lot of retail investors. And they're just like, how do you come back from that? It's really hard. It's really difficult to come back from people being like, oh, okay, well, I think this is a scam. Why would they ever go back to it then, right? And it's like, I don't know. That's a good question. And like, I think it's a pretty fair characterization of like where we are right now.
One thing that's amazing to me, one of my favorite crypto areas that I wrote about in the book was NFTs and the Bored Ape Yacht Club. Mm. These are like the monkey JPEGs that Justin Bieber and other celebrities bought for like supposedly for hundreds of thousands of dollars. I mean, people were paying like huge money for these kind of ugly derivative cartoons of monkeys wearing costumes. And like, in the book, I talk about going to Ape Fest, which was like a week-long party for holders of these monkey tokens, which was truly bizarre. It's not surprising to me that the price of Bored Apes has collapsed. But yeah, it's actually still pretty high. Like, how much a Bored Ape now, they still go for like 50 grand,
a significant amount,
right?
Yeah.
What's the floor price now?
Yeah, 40,000.
40K. Which is funny to me, because at the time when you were going to Ape Fest, you wrote that you were ready to spend about $40,000 on a mutant ape, because Bored Apes at the time were running above 200K. And now you could get a Bored Ape for what you were willing to spend on a mutant ape at that point.
I know. I could have like a really good ape now for my budget. Because this was actually the most extreme adventure in the book. People kept teasing me in crypto world. They're like, how do you know about crypto? You don't even have any. And it started to get to me. And I was like, you know what? Maybe I am missing something. I've got to try it out for myself. And at the time, I felt like the most legit thing to do would be to get one of these Bored Apes. But I'm not like a gambling guy. And, you know, so I went to tell my wife and I was like, hey, I have to talk to you about something for this book. I think I need to buy an NFT. And, you know, it's called Bored Apes. A lot of celebrities have them, but it's kind of expensive. And I think I asked for her to like guess how much it might be. And she's like, obviously knows it's going to be a lot, cause like we're sitting down, and she's like, I don't know, like $5,000. And I'm like, actually the cheapest ones are $40,000. And she was just like, what? But she was, Nikki, my wife, was like really supportive of this whole project and saw the importance of this and said, all right, you got to try it out. So I got one. I may not, by the time I went to go buy one, the price had actually crashed. So I was able to get one for $20,000, which was kind of cool, but also a bit scary that it had just gone down 50% in like a couple weeks. But I actually found this, I don't know if you guys will agree with me, but I found this to be one of the most revealing parts of looking into crypto. Like, trying to buy this Bored Ape was just so hard and so annoying. And like signing up for MetaMask and transferring the money, buying Ethereum, like at several points, I thought all my money was probably lost. And I was like, all of these people who are out promoting this as like the future of money, the future of art, have they even tried to do it? Because like, this will never see mainstream adoption. This is horrible. Like, if you don't know how it works, like essentially your MetaMask is like a browser extension. And if you like, if you lose the password to it, it's gone forever. You have to keep track of all these like addresses and codes. And like your money is basically held. I had to like send $20,000 to like this tiny fox icon in my browser. I'm getting like anxious. Just I can see it now on this my screen. It's just like bringing back bad memories. But like the idea that regular people would want to do this makes no sense. The only reason you would do it is if you thought, all right, this is pretty weird, but like my friend's getting rich off it and I can too.
What was really striking to me about that whole section was the entire pitch was about how NFTs were going to be the future and NFTs were the basis of ApeFest. You go out and purchase this and then realize that the NFT alone isn't sufficient for you to get in. You have to go through this other like ownership verification process. And as you're going through, you write about how you invented a whole backstory for your ape, Dr. Scrum, so that you would more easily be able to fit in with this community of apes. And then as you arrived, you mentioned that no one ever asked to see your ape or the story of your ape, or anything about your ape whatsoever at ApeFest, which for me was kind of striking. And when your ape did come up, it was often other people telling you that their apes were much better than your ape, and you actually had a bad ape, and you should really get a different ape.
Yeah.
Which was just a fascinating part of this, like, entire investment that built itself on community.
It was really sad. I had a great funny story about my $20,000 mutant ape, Dr. Scum, who would smoke weed to give himself superpowers, and he was a detective, and I was ready to bond with all the other ape people about it, but people would only just politely pretend to be interested, and no one wanted to hear about Dr. Scum. Yeah, I met teenagers who had way better apes. A lot of people were like drunk and high, and I met the founders of the Bored Ape Yacht Club, but even though I was in the club, they wouldn't talk to me. And I met Jimmy Fallon, who said he was there for the community, but was standing in the back with like behind his security guards and did not really want to engage with me when I tried to talk to him about how he was promoting something that people were losing like real sums of money on. Jimmy Fallon, I should say, like he's the late night host. He had Paris Hilton on his show, and they did this like really cringy segment talking about their bored apes.
I jumped in.
I know, I heard. I'm so happy I taught you what they were.
You did. You taught me what's up, and then I bought an ape.
I got an ape too, because I saw you on the show with Beeple, and you said you got a MoonPay, so I went and I copied you and did the same thing.
You did?
Mm-hmm.
This is your ape.
Are we debuting? That's really cool.
But like, yeah. I think that was actually influential. I think that really helped Bored Apes reach the next level. But
did the price go up after that? Did the price go up after that interview?
Yeah.
I'm actually curious.
MoonPay and CAA were doing their whole big like thing at that point.
MoonPay certainly helped Bored Ape.
All the celebrities were, it wasn't just Fallon and Hilton, but like Eminem at that point was doing it too. Steph Curry had gotten his like a month ago. There was a lot of them who were moving at that point.
I thought this was really crazy. I was surprised this didn't make the news at the time, but I think they're just like they wouldn't let reporters into ApeFest. You had to have the ape. Although my research assistant, Percy, had no trouble getting a free pass from some guy outside. Yeah, so at ApeFest, Snoop performed. He performed a song that was like, essentially the chorus was like, buy ApeCoin, which is like the official cryptocurrency of Bored Apes. And first of all, I was like, I think I should buy ApeCoin. Like, this is going to move the market. Snoop's like endorsing ApeCoin and like the chorus. That's like, Dogecoin doesn't have that. But also, I thought that there would be like some outrage around him shilling this investment publicly. But it really flew under the radar. I think that song just never took off, maybe. I'm not sure if he ever really released it officially.
I think that might have been a convention exclusive you saw.
Yeah, lucky you. Yeah.
Well, especially since, as you mentioned, there was, as part of one of the lawsuits against Yuga Labs, there's an allegation that Snoop owns an equity stake in Yuga, right?
Yes, and I don't think he's disputed that, but I'm not sure. Like, I'm of the age where, like, Snoop and Eminem are, like, the coolest guys around. Like, some of my favorite rappers, right? So I found it like, and Eminem has like, I feel like he has not really sold out, right? Like he's kind of like, he speaks out when he thinks something about politics. So where Snoop, I mean, he does a lot of ads, but like, I found it kind of depressing to see them on stage promoting Bored Apes. So it was almost like a relief for me to learn that like Snoop had an equity stake in Yuga Labs and that explained it. And he wasn't like a real Bored Ape fan. I mean, maybe he is. I don't know.
You're so glad that he's just a normal shill.
There was that thing where that one NFT account, Cosimo de Medici or whatever, said they were Snoop, pretended to be Snoop, was run by Snoop's assistant. Some weird thing with that like a year and a half ago, right?
Oh, I totally missed that. I thought that was just like one of these non-NFT collectors who built some like $10 million collection that's probably, you know, now worth a lot less.
I think we're running out of time here. I think we could probably talk about all of the insane stories in your book, Number Go Up, for hours and hours and hours. But I think we should call it here. Zeke, is there anything like you would like to leave us with in terms of like your experience writing this book or what it means to you, or if you think there's, you know, more stories that need to be told in crypto? I don't know, whatever you want to talk about to send us off here.
I think one day we're going to need to, our grandkids are going to be like, Grandpa, why did Justin Bieber pay $1 million for that monkey cartoon? And Number Go Up is like, that's the answer. Like, go. Nice. We're gonna pick up a copy. It's gonna like explain this whole mania and help you remember all of these like crazy characters who got super rich off the stupidest bubble of all time.
Well, fantastic. Thank you, Zeke. It's been memorable and wonderful to have you on.
And everyone,
thanks, guys.
And everyone, make sure to check out Number Go Up. I will echo Cass in saying that this is absolutely one of the best cryptocurrency books I've ever read, and I'll give it an unequivocal recommendation.
Thank you.
12 out of 10. Number Go Up.
Keep up the good work, guys. I always like really like following all the leads that you dig up.
Thank you.
We thank you so much.